controversy on what step we're on. And quite frankly, I really don't care. Because whenever Russell speaks, it's just good for my soul. So he can talk about anything he wants. I'm okay with that. And with that, I give you Russell.
Hi, everybody. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's great to be here. I happened to go to a 7 o'clock meeting this morning. It was wonderful, and it's good to sort of end up today being at this meeting. And I'm going to talk about something, and it's going to have something to do with the four-step, hopefully. But, you know, who knows? Whatever. It's only an hour. We're not invading Afghanistan or anything, and this has nothing to do with printing money or the deficit, or so nobody's going to die. And I'm just going to share a little experience, strength, and hope. I don't know where it's going to go. I don't prepare too much for this, which you'll probably, no doubt, understand after you hear a little bit about what I have to say. I have a little something I want to talk about as far as the fourth step is concerned. First of all, how many people have actually done the fourth step? Okay, how many people haven't done the fourth step? Okay, well, you know, I want to read a couple things from the book and then just give some experiences. You know, I'm an attorney. You all know that. Some of you guys know that. And I have a little problem sometimes I grapple with. I noticed it happened today. I've been an attorney for 35 years. I'd like to think I'm a good attorney, you know, when people hire me, they pay me good money, a lot of money. And I'm going to share with you a little bit of my problem because it has something to do with what we're going to talk about today. It has something to do with the fourth step, you know. Here's my problem, you know. I'm an attorney. I represent people. I have a problem with clients. I don't like them. Now, it's not that I don't like them. I mean, they're nice people, but, you know, I would rather do my job without having to actually talk to them. It's very upsetting. It reminds me of talking to, like, sponsees, you know, or, you know, it reminds me, you understand what I mean? And I'm going to try to explain this to you. Now, of course, you guys are laughing. You don't know what it's like. Because I can tell you guys, as far as intelligence is concerned, are really a cut above the average alcoholic. I can sort of tell by looking at y'all. But I'm going to tell you what my problem with some of these people are. It's funny how amazing how whenever clients come to my office, and they usually come to my office because they're in some incredible jam. I was telling James and a couple other people at the table how people, intelligent people, who run businesses, who make lots of money, who, you know, father children and grandchildren, how they walk, they talk, they vote, they have driver's license, how they can walk to my office at 40 years old, 50 years old, 60 years old, and dump on my desk the most extraordinary problem you could ever imagine. You can't even imagine the jams that a person can get themselves in. And I'm not talking about jams like it happened overnight. I mean, stuff that they've been sort of building on and constructing on and threading through and knitting together for 20 years. You know what I mean? And, of course, then they come in, they dump it on your desk, they'd like to resolve it in 5 minutes. You know, that kind of thing. And so I want to talk a little bit about that because it has a lot to do with alcoholism and the way we think. But let me read a couple of things. I want to read this little thing, the guy in the glass. You guys heard this thing. It says, when you get what you want and you struggle for self and the world make, well, actually, that's wrong. The actual translation is it's not struggle for self. It's struggle for pelf, P-E-L-F, which is like money, things, property, stuff like that. Which if you're an alcoholic, that's what this world is all about for you. When you get what you want and you struggle for pelf and the world makes you king for a day, just go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass. The fellow whose verdict counts most in your life is the one staring back in the glass. You may be like Jack Horner and chisel a plum and think you're a wonderful guy, but the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear up to the end. And you've passed your most dangerous, difficult test if the man in the glass is your friend. You may fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartache and tears if you cheated the man in the glass. You know, Bill Wilson said, you know, the next frontier is emotional sobriety. He also said one of the biggest problems alcoholics have in getting to emotional sobriety is is unhealthy dependencies. But it's even more than that. It's unhealthy thinking. You know, it's really, I'm not only an alcoholic. You know, alcohol, drinking alcohol is really a symptom of our disease. That's what the book says. This is the, by the way, this is the basic text. It hasn't been changed in like 70 years because so many people have gotten sober. This is the basic, this is our textbook. It says like clear-cut directions. We all agree on this. We finally can agree on this deal. So I'm going to read some stuff from this book. And, you know, because how well you do is going to ultimately depend on how well you really agree with this book. You know, there's a lot of people that hang around AA and say they're alcoholics and say they're members of Alcoholics Anonymous and they drink coffee and they become secretaries, group and all that sort of stuff. But you want some? They don't necessarily, trust me, believe in what's put down in this book. You see, being in Alcoholics Anonymous, now listen, we know there's no rules in AA, right? Because alcoholics don't even like that word. They don't like to follow. They don't want to obey. They you know, we want to do our own thing and everything like that. But I'm going to tell you something. If it is true that this is our basic text, and if it is true that the people that do exceedingly well in here basically conform themselves to the program of action that's laid out in these steps in this book, including the steps and everything else that's put in, if that's true, and I don't know if that's true or not, I tend to think it's true. If that's true, and they just don't do their own thing, okay, and they sort of model their life over after what's put down in this book, it's really interesting. It'd be an interesting thing to really see how many people actually believe what is in this book, and just actually give lip service to it and don't really believe it. You know, I mean, this book talks about doing certain steps and doing certain things and living a certain type of life. Now, not that anybody does it perfectly, but how many people actually do it? How many people actually do the steps? How many people actually believe what they're saying in here? So I just want to read a few things that, you know, may be pertinent, and I'm going to tell you how it worked out in my life, because I don't do this thing perfectly. But things have gotten better. They've gotten pretty good. You know, my wife, you know, I'm a pretty sharp guy, smart. I'm not a stupid guy, you know, and I graduated law school. I was, you know, very high in my class, and now Science Foundation Fellow and all sorts of stuff and accolades and stuff. You know, I'm the guy, remember I told my first sponsor, look at all the degrees on my wall, and that's the guy who was a dropout from Chicago. He looked at my degrees, he says, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. So that... You know, there's book sense and then there's common sense. So, you know, with all my, so I'm married to this wonderful, wonderful young lady. Just a wonderful, she gives me a beautiful son. I'm living in a beautiful house on Miami Beach, on the golf course, on Lagos Golf Course, on the 11th hole. I've got it all. I'm 25 years old. I'm an attorney. I'm a division chief in the state attorney's office, trying murder cases. Okay, I got the whole deal. And I'm sober, and I'm intelligent, I think. I've got guys working underneath me. Very heady stuff. My name's in the paper. And my wife one day says to me, as I'm a Friday morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm as sober then as I am right now. Probably a lot smarter. Many more neurons working, you know? Because when I came to AA, I had only two neurons working. Only two neurons were working, and they were waving goodbye at each other, you know? And so, and let me tell you something, smart can kill you in here. And so I walk out and I'm bright, bright and bushy-tailed and ready to go. And my wife looks at me and she says the following. I just want you to know, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. That's the exact words. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. It's like 11 words. Actually, I can't think of any word you could actually take out of that sentence. I think they're all necessary. You know, there's not a word you could take out. It's like a tight sentence, right? If you come home, the first thing I hear, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. Now, I think that, you know, if you're intelligent and, you know, you got a few brain cells working, something like that ought to be pretty clear, ought to make sense, you know what I mean? So here's the problem. Here's what you got to realize. Now, I didn't realize this then. I realize it now. When I got to the stoplight, when I got in my car, and by the way, I didn't forget what she said, because that night, when I stepped up to the bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and took my first drink, I told my friend, my drinking buddy, I have to get home. You don't understand, because Ronnie told me if I come home drunk one more time, she's leaving me, and I've got to get home. So I remembered it. It's not like I forgot it. You know what I mean? And I guess I sort of knew what it was. But here's the deal. Here's the problem. She says that to me. I drive my car out the driveway, and I get to the first light, and this is what I thought. What the hell did she mean by that? Now, here's what my suggestion is. Okay, here's my now. Listen. Do you know what she meant by that? Well, evidently, what she meant, because I came home drunk, and she kicked me out of that house. She kicked me out of the house, and that was the end of my marriage. So apparently, what she meant when she said, "If you come home drunk more time, I'm leaving you," is, you ready for this? This is a shocker. That if I was to come home drunk more time, she would be leaving me. I know that doesn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense to me either. You know what I mean? It doesn't it really, you know. It's like you said, how did I get in this jam? So here's my theory on this deal. If you're an intelligent person working the planet Earth, and with all sorts of problems and things going on in your life, no matter how smart you are, no matter how much money you have, if you don't understand the spirit and the words and the essence behind the statement, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you, if you don't get that, somewhere down the line, it's going to wreck a lot of havoc in your life somewhere. In other words, there's something missing in the DNA pattern or in the brain pattern where I don't care how well you're doing, somewhere down the road, Brittany, they're taking your kids away from you. Somewhere down the road, Charlie, they're taking that show away from you. Somewhere down the road, no matter how well you're doing, you're going to start losing arms, legs, and limbs, not because you're not talented or you can't sing or you can't do math, but because you just don't understand an 11-word sentence. You know, you just don't understand it. And that's the problem. You see, there's something wrong with my thinking. You know, the drinking is really just a symptom of my disease. My disease centers in my mind, not my body. And one of the major problems with my disease is, you ready for this? This is the best way I can say it. I'm not a psychologist. Is I'm crazy. I'm crazy. I really shouldn't be allowed on the street, but here's the worst part. But I don't know it. I'm crazy, but I don't know it. As a matter of fact, it's worse than that. I think I'm smart. I think I'm smarter than anybody else and everybody else. As a matter of fact, I not only think I'm smarter than everybody else, but as the evidence is piling up around me and I'm going down the tubes, I think even stronger than I'm smarter. I feel even stronger that I know what's best for me. And so we come to this deal right here where it says, if that's true, now I'm going to tell you something. Based upon my experience as an alcoholic, before and after and coming in here, and based upon what I read in this book, I personally believe, this is just my opinion, you don't have to buy into it, that is true. You know, the 12 and 12 says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his devastating weakness, whatever that is. Now, if you want, you can think it's just drinking. But if it's just drinking, you don't need these meetings, just don't drink, you'll be wonderful. I mean, you got people in here that got 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years sobriety, and they'll be the first to tell you it ain't just drinking, because I haven't had a drink in 20 years and I'm nuts. I'm capable of all sorts of problems, of making all sorts of screw-ups and mistakes. And if you've been here more than 18 months, you know it's not just drinking. You know drinking is just a symptom of the problem. You know, drinking is what happens when the ism gets out of control that we use in order to combat. You know, the problem is the thinking. Listen, let me tell you something. I've gotten to the point with 30 years sobriety, thank God, and it's really through the grace of God that most of the time my brain's on idle. I do real great on idle. It's amazing how good you can do on life with just at like 10 RPM. Now I'm going to tell you something. I'm not a car guy, so I may not know what I'm talking about, but you know, if you have a car and it's idling at like 10,000 RPM, that's probably not a good thing. The engine's going to wear out or something like that. But you see, if your whole life is at 10,000 RPM, if you're always at 10,000 RPM, a million thoughts per second, you know what I mean? You don't know you're at 10,000 RPM Because that's just the way you are. This is just the way you've always been, and this is the way you think. So an alcoholic life seems the only normal life to him. And the world is crazy, and you feel crazy, and stuff bothers you, and your restlessness, your illness, and because you've never been at zero RPM. You came out of the womb at 10,000 RPM, and the only time it dipped down to like 5,000 RPM is when you had a few drinks. Then it would dip down to 5,000, and that would feel pretty good, and then it was up again. You know, so my problem is not drinking. Drinking is what brings me down to at least 5,000 RPM. My problem is not drinking. So the way it is right now, because of this programming house, is like now most of the time I'm like at, 10 RPM. You know, like I'm real low. And I'll tell you one thing. When you live your life at 10 RPM, not only do you feel great, but you can do sprints real well. I can sprint real well. I mean, I can go 10 RPM, 10 RPM, 10 more RPM. I got to go to the bathroom, that's like 15 RPM. Go back down to 10 RPM. I feel like eating lunch, go up to like 12 RPM. What am I going to eat? That's like 13 RPM, you know. Go back down again. You hit a sponsor, he has a problem, you know, you get like 11 RPM. I can do that pretty. And every once in a while, a client will come in and I have to think about something. I'll sort of shoot up to like about 5,000 RPM, but it's only for like 5 minutes, and then I'm back down again. You know, I come down real fast. You know, if you're an alcoholic and you're at 10,000 RPM and something happens, you shoot up to 100,000 RPM and then you stay there for a week in 10 meetings. You know what I mean? Because you can't come down. You know, that's the way we're up. So, you know, but I'm really bad at marathon thinking. See, what I'm really bad at is marathon thinking. Y'all ever have, anybody here ever been anxious about a problem? No. You know, when you're anxious about a problem, do you think about it like for 10 seconds? How about like an hour or two, all day, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, you go to sleep thinking about it. You see, marathon thinking is for the birds. But marathon worrying and marathon, and you want something, the more you think, the worse it gets. You know, the more you think, the worse it gets. I was talking to John about a problem with a client or somebody we were talking about. I said, you know what his real problem is? I said, his real problem is not legal. He's got a 5% legal problem. He's got a 95% emotional problem. He can't stop thinking about it. It's killing him. That's the problem. He can't stop thinking about it. It's killing him. And that's us. We're restless. We're irritable. We're discontented. We're delusional. And we think we're smart. And we think we have to think. We don't know any other way of doing it. You know, and unless and until an alcoholic accepts his devastating weakness. And this is one of our weaknesses. We're thinkaholics. We're powerless over our thinking. You know, Abraham Lincoln has that line, most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be, except alcoholics, because they can't make up their minds to be anything. Because it just goes, it's unmanageable thinking. Unless until an alcoholic accepts his devastating weakness and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious, and of true happiness, he'll find none at all. That's in our literature. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Now listen to this. This is not me talking. This is alcohol. You know, I get credit for reading crap out of Alcoholics Anonymous. People like are amazed. They say, you know, when you said that, that was amazing. And I say, you mean when I read that? And you know why they think it's amazing? Because they never read it. They never read it. And it's not necessarily because they didn't read the book. They read the book, like alcoholics read the book. You know how alcoholics read the book? They read the book. They read the book. They read the book. Then you ask them, what did they read this, Alan? You know, when they hear selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, they read that. They'll read every word. And you know, yeah, that's exactly, they do exactly what I did with my ex-wife and what they meant by that. And then they move on to the next sentence. So they'll read a whole chapter. They'll read the whole thing. It'll mean absolutely nothing to them. It means to them exactly what it meant to me. In other words, you can read this book. You can outline this book. You can do all that 20 years down the road after practicing this thing in your life and applying it to your life, you'll have some inkling of understanding what they're talking about. But it won't be until after the cops leave, after the cops are called, after the wife kicks you out, and after all the damage is done, and you're 10 years down the road and you're talking at an AA meeting, you'll be able to explain to them, it'll be a big joke, and you'll be able to explain to them how you got to the first stoplight, and you said to yourself, I wonder what she means by that. And somebody will say, did you read the book? And you'll say, yeah, I read the book. But the truth is, you don't really understand what they're talking about. maybe someday you'll hear a guy talking and something, you'll get like a clue. You just want to hang out until it all starts making sense 10 or 15 years down the road. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms. You know, this is, they're talking about you and I. You want to know, hey, is anybody interested in what's wrong? You ever say, what's wrong with me? Have you ever said to yourself, what the hell is wrong with me? Okay, well, this is what's wrong with you. You're driven, if you're in here, you're driven by 100 forms of fear. Listen, we ain't talking about just one form. Just on the fear part, there's like 100 forms. And the truth is, they were sort of like making an understatement. It's probably more like 20,000 forms, you know what I mean? So you got 100 forms of fear. I mean, they take weird forms. They take forms that you don't even realize. Like, guys will come up to me, sponsors will come up to me, and they'll say, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about that, I'm worried about the end, I think this, I'm worried about it. I said, oh, so you're scared. He says, no, I'm not scared. I mean, it's like 100 forms. Forms you don't even recognize. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion. That means we're deluded. Self-seeking and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So the troubles we think are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, our own thinking. Our own thinking, which is a problem because we're like toxic waste. You can't stop thinking. You know, don't you wish sometimes, you ever say this, I got to stop thinking about this, I got to stop worrying about this. This thing is killing me. I got to stop worrying about this. What can I do to work? You can't drink over it. You used to drink. That's what we used to do. You know how you stop worrying over things? You drink. Drinking is like committing suicide temporarily. It's like you ever say, I wish I was dead? Well, drinking is a way of being dead. It's a way of going into a coma, being dead, not thinking, dying, but, you know, it could be like Lazarus. You'd come out of the grave, you know, the next day, you know, get back into the fight. That's why we drink. It's like committing suicide, but it's not a scary committing suicide because you keep on breathing. You know? That's why when you stop drinking, you spend most of the time thinking you wish you're thinking of suicide. Because if you can't drink, then you might as well kill you. You see, drinking is absolutely out of the question, but suicide is a possibility. Because it'll stop. You know why? Because if you commit suicide, then at least that'll stop you from thinking. Because you can't stop thinking. And you're thinking our uncomfortable thoughts about you and other people, and they're killing you. You can't tell anybody about it because you know they won't understand. It's a serious disease. It's a pretty serious disease, let me tell you. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of cell phone riot, though he usually doesn't think so. And that's the scary part. I mean, it's one thing when you're like your guys, and you're here, and you got like an inkling, where you got a shot, you got an inkling of saying, yeah, man, this really is there. And at least you see maybe a little bit of that. Imagine for every one of you guys, there's 1,000 or 10,000 other people that don't understand the word I'm saying, and they don't agree with it. You see, here's this book. Let me tell you something. For every alcoholic in here, in AA, that agrees with this book, there's 5,000 alcoholics outside of AA that thinks this is a bunch of horse shit. As a matter of fact, if you try to talk about it, they'll say, go to hell. You're stupid, you don't know what you're talking about. They'll fight for the right, they'll think you're stupid. And I'm going to tell you something else. For every one alcoholic that agrees with this book inside here, there's probably 10 alcoholics in here that are sober that think that most of this is bullshit. They won't tell you that. They think they're doing this. But if you point out certain things, you say certain things, say, yeah, well, that's for you. You work your program, I'll work mine. They just work the things they want to work, and they do the stuff they know, and they don't do the stuff they don't want to do. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of the selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. Hey, that's where half of us take a right turn and get out of here. We had to have God's help. Now, here's a line. I want to give you this line. This is just a throwaway line. This is the how and why of it. You ready? People go to step meetings. I used to go to step meetings because I want to learn how to do the steps. I want to learn what the disease is about. I want to learn what the solution is about, right? So listen to this. It says, this is the how and why of it. It's sort of like one of those statements that says, the great fact is just this and nothing less. I mean, you really want to perk up and say, well, now they're going to give us the answer. This is the how and why of it, okay? First of all, first thing right off the bat. You ready for the first thing? We had to quit playing God. Now, here's the problem with that. What the hell are they talking about? Sounds great, doesn't it? And it's probably, now let me suggest something to you. It's probably important. What do you think? You think it's important?
Yeah.
So let me suggest something to you. If it sounds good, and if it's probably really important that you have to quit playing God, I would think you'd want to know what the hell they're talking about. Because what if you're playing God and you don't know you're playing God? Because you know it says one of the problems is with self-will run riot. Self-will, not God-will. But we really don't think so. So how do you know when you're playing God and when you're not playing God? Well, I could give you an answer that I'm sort of satisfied with. It's a general answer, so it could be maybe wrong, but you wouldn't like my answer. But you want to hear it anyway? Because I got nothing better to do except stir you up and get you crazy. I'll tell you when you know when you're playing God. When you're thinking. When you're thinking. When you're thinking, because when you're thinking, you know what you're thinking about? You're thinking about what you should do or what you have to do or what you can do to manage your own life so that you'll be safe and you'll get what you need and you want. You're thinking, you're worrying, you're trying to have control over. Not when you're praying, not when you're asking God's help. When you're thinking about your life and managing your life, overthinking, intensely thinking, you're doing God's job. You know, because you know something, if it's in God's will and you're plugged into God's will and you've got that maintaining that spiritual condition, it's like idle time, folks. Not much thinking involved. As a matter of fact, they have something in here later on in the 11th step called inspirational thinking. It says the answers just come. It says it's easy. We go crazy with this. We says we come to rely on that type of thinking. Where you go through life from morning, noon to night, handling all sorts of problems, and it hardly goes up on the meter. And you just sort of glide through life and handling stuff, and rough stuff happens, and cancer happens, and bankruptcy happens, and people come in, and all sorts of stuff happens. And there's not a lot of thinking because, you know, you're really not called upon to think because the answers just come. The answers just come if your house is in order. Hey, listen, don't look at me like I'm crazy. I'm just quoting from the book. So if you believe that's bullshit, then what you're saying is you don't agree with the book. And if that's not your life, well, I don't know what to tell you. It's just not your life yet. And so if we start realizing now to go into the sickness of the thinking, and the reason I want to harp on the thinking is because that's really what the fourth step is about, causing conditions in the thinking, changing around our thinking. And the thing about the clients, because I don't want to get off of that, and I used to work relay for 8 years in Dade County. And from 11 o'clock, Friday nights from 11 o'clock at night till 8 o'clock in the morning, if you're an alcoholic, an alky, drunk or sober, and you called up Alcoholics Anonymous, you got me. Which is why for 8 years nobody got sober. But anyway, let me tell you something. It's a great gig if you can get it. If you can get that deal, now you've got to be crazy to apply for it. Or you got to sign up some sponsor that forces you to apply for it. First of all, you got to understand something. Any job in AA that you apply for like that, you can't get rid of it. It's not like people tap you on the shoulder and say, "Can I have that job?" You understand? They don't fire you from that job. Nobody calls you up and says, "We don't want you to have that job anymore." As long as you feel free, you will have that job until the day they lower you into the ground. Unless you can figure out a way to weasel out of it, okay? But, you know, most of the time when I had that job and I was on the phone with Alcoholics, they would say things like this. I heard a lot of this. "No, no, no, let me talk. No, 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 you got to listen to me. You're not listening to me. You got to listen to me." Now, I want to explain something to you. I'm on the phone with a guy or a gal whose life is in the shit can. His entire life exploded. He's lost his kids. He's lost his eyeballs. He's lost his thumbs. You know what I mean? He's fired. He hasn't had a job in 16 years. They took away his bar card, okay? You know what I mean? He used to be a doctor, but now, you know, like he's picking up bananas off the side of the road. He's got nothing else to do. He has no friends. He's living on the street. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, he calls me up because he wants help, right? He wants to talk to somebody. And he gets me on the other end. And I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, listen, you got to listen to me. Because he wants to argue me into his point of view. He wants me to understand what's going on so I will understand what has to be. He wants to like enlist me in his army so that I agree with him. And he wants me to think like him. Because if only I could think like him, then I would understand. And we could both be picking up bananas on the side of the street. So I have these clients that come to see me. They pay me a fee for a consultation. I got all these, you know, you remember the degrees on the wall. They've gotten bigger, actually, since I've been in. I got more degrees. And they come in to see me, and they're paying me money, you know, which is why I would, why else would I speak with them? They're paying me money, and they come in, and they say this to me. And here's where they come in. For 10 years, they've been doing crazy things. I don't know, not paying taxes. I don't know, whatever. Marriage gone bad, whatever it is. They're crazy. They may not even be alcoholic. They're just crazy, you know? And they sit down, and they say things to me like this. You got to listen to me. You don't understand. No, you're not listening to me. You know what I mean? You got to listen to what you don't get it. You don't understand. I can't do that, you know? Because you know why? Because they've totally destroyed their life. And they come to me to try to fix it up. And now they're trying to enlist me to argue with me to get me to deal with this and think about this the way they deal with it and think about this. In other words, they're the problem. Their best thinking on their best day got them in this situation. You know, Albert Einstein said the level of thinking that we need in order to get us out of a problem has to be greater than the level of thinking that got us into the problem. So they come to me. They're absolutely stark raving crazy. They're emotional. They think they're right. You don't understand. You know, he did this. It's his fault. It's their fault and everything. And the one thing that they are is absolutely sincere. These aren't phony balonies in the sense that they're lying. They are lying, and they are dishonest, and they don't see the truth. But they don't know that. They believe they're 100% right, and if you don't get it, they get mad and they get frustrated. And you know what I'm talking about, because you are that, and you live with that, and you hear that all the time. And they come to me, and they pay me money to help them, and then they sit there for an hour or 2 hours trying to get me to do things the way they've been doing it for 10 years, you understand? And to argue me into seeing things from their point of view. And I have a sign on my wall that says, you know, from the movie A Few Good Men, it says, the truth, you can't handle the truth. And I spend most of my time with these people trying to, in some way, somehow, through talking to them, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, to sort of bring them to have some inkling of understanding that you will get if you do a fourth and fifth step. Some clarity of understanding their life where all of a sudden there's like an aha moment and they go, oh, I see. I never looked at that. Man, I'll tell you, the greatest thing you hear is somebody says, I never thought of that. I never looked at it that way. I never looked at it that way. I must have been crazy. Because I know if I can bring them to that point, we got a shot of not only getting them out of that deal, but they'll never get involved in that deal again. But they're so locked into their worldview and their way of seeing things and their way of acting that it's impossible. It's hard to argue them out of it. With alcoholics, it's absolutely impossible. It's impossible. It's impossible. It will frustrate the hell out of you. It'll drive you crazy. You will be dealing with people. They have chips on their shoulder. They have resentments. You try to talk to them, they'll get mad at you. You don't understand. You're unfair. And of course, if you're an alcoholic, so you're somewhat codependent and you want everybody to love you, you'll get all hurt that they're mad at you, and you'll think that maybe you did something wrong. You know, you hurt their feelings or something like that. And what you realize is that this disease is so insidious, the thinking is so insidious, that unless something unless God touches them or something horrible happens to them, where they lose the job, lose the leg, lose the kids, something happens to them, they don't have a shot of even seeing the world the way it really is. Not on planet Russell, you know, or on planet, Planet Alex, you know what I mean? But the way the world really is. So we walk in here and you're dealing with these alcoholics, and you know what they think they are? They think they're victims. They're victims. You don't understand, I did anything wrong. The world has done something wrong to me. My ex-wife is a bitch. You know, the judge is an idiot. The cop was wrong. You know what I mean? Everybody is out to get him. They didn't do anything wrong. Yeah, I did that, but I wouldn't have done that if this guy... They're victims, and they're blaming, and they didn't do anything wrong. And even if they did something wrong, they're really not to blame. They got an alibi. And, you know, here's the weird thing. Nobody else sees it except for them. They really are on a different planet. They really are delusional. Nobody sees it except for them. The judge didn't see it that way. The jury didn't see it that way. The cops didn't see it that way. Their ex-wife didn't see it that way. Hey, it gets even better. When they talk about an AA meeting, the people in AA don't see it that way. That's what I mean. The people in AA, their sponsor, they tell their sponsor, they say, what are you, crazy? They don't see it that way. But you know something? They sincerely see it that way. They're at the stop sign and they're saying, what the hell do they mean by that? Their whole life is, what the hell do they mean by that? So I'm going to tell you something. You can come in here. You can come in here and you can put the plug in the jug and you can stop drinking. But if you don't change your way of thinking and the way you look at things, you're a dead man walking. It's just a matter of time. You just ain't going to make it. And the problem is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they will give you chips, they will give you medallions, they will applaud you, they will tell you how much they love you, you will get all the crap, and you can get away with it for years without actually doing the scud work of changing your thinking. And then one day, 9 years later, you put a bullet in your head, or you drank yourself to death, or something went wrong, because they never really changed. All you did was just hang around here like you were hanging around a bar and drinking coffee and making a new set of friends. You know, friendships and buddies and hanging around here, you know, and getting some sort of new identity, you know, as the group idiot or the group clown or the group, you know, angry guy, or getting some sort of nickname here, Angry George, Mad Fred, whatever it is, you know, that'll keep you, if you're an alcoholic and you got no place else to live, that'll keep you in AA for years, keep you even physically sober. But it won't get you to that fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. You know, it ain't going to get you rocketing in the fourth dimension of existence. It's not going to get you idle. At zero or at 5 miles per hour, it's not going to get you with that idle deal. You're still going to be a whack job. You're still going to be doing things like, no, you got to listen to me. You're still going to be trying to listen to people to your point of view. Nobody's going to ask you to sponsor them because nobody wants what you have. Nobody wants it. You know, and you're not interested in sponsoring people anyway. Because why? Because you're the victim. You just want to talk about yourself or think about yourself. You even think AA is for crap. You're the guy who sits in the back of the room and say, it's all bullshit. This God thing's bullshit. This thing's bullshit. It's all crap. You just got a crummy attitude, but you're sober. I've been sober for 20 years. It's all a bunch of bullshit. Just don't drink. You know what I mean? As everybody runs up to you and say, will you sponsor me? Because I'd sure like to have what you have. You sound just so happy and joyous. You know what I mean? With your life and everything like that. And so that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with, but you see, it takes a lot of humility. You know, when you think you're brilliant. And all alcoholics think they're brilliant. And you think you're right, and all alcoholics think they're right. And you don't really see any problem with your thinking because, well, hell, this is the way I've thought all my life. I don't see any problem with my thinking. This is the way I thought all my life. As a matter of fact, this thinking got, hey, this got me through school. This got me a bachelor's degree. I got a master's degree. I got a doctorate. Hey, I got a job. I got a this. I got a car. I got my thinking is perfectly okay. When that's the way you think, and especially if you don't have a sponsor to tell you how stupid you are, you know, really, if you don't get a sponsor to explain to you how crazy you are, somebody you can trust that you like, who actually takes you inside and says, Russell, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. If you don't get a guy like that in your life, or if you get a guy like that and you say, well, screw you, and you leave him so that nobody's going to take the time to tell you how stupid you are or what an idiot you are, or how you're screwing up, if you can't handle a rebuke and you don't have men in your life that are able to look you in the eye and say, you're not as hot as you think you are, you got a lot of problems, you better work on that stuff, and you can't listen to them because you cannot submit yourself to another human being. If you can't do that, where are you either going to get the information or the inclination to do anything? You'll just sort of coast along in Alcoholics Anonymous, thinking you're staying sober because you're collecting days. And at the end of the deal, you won't be any better off than you were when you first started. You'll be like the guy in the glass. You'll get pats on the back as you pass. But at the end, you know, you'll be looking in the mirror and you'll say, what the hell am I? I got nothing. I don't have anything they have. And you may not even do a four step. And you just sort of coast along. You know, I'm not going to tell you how to do it. I mean, there's four lists in the book. I'm one of these guys that believe, I'm not saying you did wrong if you didn't do that way, that if you're gonna do it, you might as well start off with the way they did it in the big book. That's the way I did it. Not because I was smart. I didn't know how to do it. I was flown around. Some guy said, well, there's, you know, read the book. I looked at the four lists. There were four lists. A list of resentments. Tells you what to do with a list of resentment. List of wrongs. List of fears. You know, list of wrongs and hurts we cause to other people because of the sexual deal. Four lists. I wrote them all down. It was probably the worst four step. Doesn't have to be perfect. It was the worst four step I could have ever done in my life. It was just the best one I could do that day. It took me 2 hours. Didn't take me six. I did mine after 18 months. It took me exactly 18 months and 2 hours to do my four step list. For 18 months, I agonized. How do I do it? What do I do? I write it. And then I finally sat down and I did it. It took me 2 hours. I just did the chart in the book. I followed what it did. You know, and then I discovered, you want to know something? You know, 3 weeks later, I did something else. Some stuff I left out. I did something else. I just did it. But, you know, the thing that I had going for me, really, I think, is two things, a couple of things. First of all, I had a sponsor, and I had an AA daddy and AA uncles. You know, I had a sponsor with like 20-something years and some people around me that, because I have an ego. I'm like all you guys. I got an ego. And I want to, and you know, when you got an ego like mine, you're either worse than anybody else or better than everybody else. You know what I mean? And even when you're worse than everybody else, you tell yourself you're better than everybody else. And I need men there that would tell me the truth. And, you know, sometimes the way they play this thing, it's like an art form. Sometimes they spank you, and sometimes they kick you in the ass, and sometimes they put their arms around you and tell you how much they love you. But somehow, through the... It's like working those little doggies, you know, like on the range, you know, it's like the shepherd with the crook, you know, they push them, they pull them, and everything, they keep them on the road. And somehow they kept on pointing me at the steps. Sarcasm actually works very well with me. I have a guy sponsor, he tells this story. I think it's kind of a cute story because it's true. He said, and this is a true story, he said his wife kept on complaining about his drinking, so finally got into AA, and I became his sponsor, and he stopped drinking. To this day, he's sober. He's got like 12 years. And she went to see her psychiatrist because she told him the story, and I had met her a couple of times. She had met me, and so she said she was complaining that he's going to all these meetings, and he says, and the psychiatrist said, he says, yeah, but he's not drinking. He says, yeah, but he goes to all these meetings. He says, but he's not drinking. And so he says, well, does he have a sponsor? He says, yeah. And the guy's real obnoxious. He's talking about me. And the psychiatrist said, he says, you know, obnoxious works for some people. You know, for some people, a pat on the back and you kiss them and you hug them, we love them. And you know what they do? They take that, they throw it in the toilet and they walk away. You know, for me, sarcasm and obnoxious works for me. You know, I'm a New York kid. You know, I think I'm a smart aleck. I'm a smart ass. You know, you put somebody in my face who looks at me and says, why don't you go drink? You're an idiot, you know, or something like that. Somehow, I know he loves me. You know what I mean? I eat lunch with about anywhere between 6 and 15 people every day, men, every day. You know, it goes out. Some of the guys are here that I eat lunch with. We have a lost sheep lunch at the end of every month. This Friday we'll have one. We'll get 30 and 40 guys. And we sit around. And we beat up somebody. We just pick somebody to beat up. Usually we don't, it's not hard to pick them. They sort of like, you know what? They don't realize they're doing it, but it's almost like they stand up and they say, beat me up. They start talking and they say something, you know? And we just level them. We even tell guys, they say, you know, we're going to be pick on you unmercifully. Your job is, if you want us to stop, you got to get somebody more pathetic than you. You've got to replace yourself. You know what I mean? Somehow with men, I'm not saying it works that way with women. Somehow with men, you know, and I've seen this happen, that stuff works with them. That was something, you know, it says in the 12 and 12, how do we get a new perspective? Through repeated forms of humiliation, the final crushing of ourselves. Somehow that kind of gentle sort of humiliation and rebuking and everything like that, it works with guys. You know what I mean? They sort of laugh it off, you know, like, women is a different story. You tell a woman, what are you, stupid or something like that? And she's like gone for 10 years, you know what I mean? She's checked into a home for battered spouses and, you know, it's trauma, you know, she's on Law and Order and it's a whole trauma thing, you know? With a guy, you say, what are you, stupid? And he says, oh, finally I met guys that I really like and they like me too, you know? We're delusional, you know? You can kick them, they come back and everything like that. But the bottom line is because of that and because I want to be with these guys, I ultimately had to do a written four-step. I did it. And it worked for me. It worked almost immediately. A lot of stuff that was bothering me went away right away, and then I worked on the rest. I actually did it. It's in the book, you know. And as a result of doing the four-step, one of the results of doing the fourth and fifth step is 90% of the stuff that you worry about that keeps you at that 10,000 RPM, maybe not 90%, maybe it's only 50%, maybe it's 30%, just leaves. So you're not idling at 10,000 RPM anymore. You're idling at 6,500 RPM. And then you do 8 and 9. You know, you're idling at 2,500 RPM, you know? 10, 11, and 12, and you're down to like 1,500 RPM. Then a few years go past, and the next thing you know, you're like dead. You're mentally dead. You know? Well, ignorance really is bliss, you know? I'm doing a lot better now that I'm not running the world and I don't have to think a lot. You'd be surprised how well you can do when you know what I figured out? 90% of the stuff that goes on around me is absolutely none of my business. I have no business thinking about it. Guys come up to me and say, what do you think about this? I say, I don't. I don't even get to the threshold, the ante of thinking about it. Here's what I figure. If I start thinking about it, to give them the answers to what I'm thinking about, then I'm going to start thinking about it. And that's going to raise the RPM. And why should I think about it? Just because they suggest I think about it? I don't let things into my mind just because some alcoholic comes up to me and says, put this in your mind. You know, I studied the Bible and I studied the big book. You know, the Bible says, think of these things. Whatever's good, what is it? What's ever pleasant, what's ever of good report, think of these things. Have you ever considered when people come up to you in your life, the people you hang out with, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they start talking to you, how many people are basically cajoling you or putting bait out for you to think about things that will make you uncomfortable? That you have no right to. You're minding your own business and some guy starts talking to you about some stuff that you'd be better off if you weren't in his presence. And because you're an alcoholic and you're codependent, you know what? You feel like you got to listen to him because, you know, they say things like, you got to listen to me. Yeah. And you think it's like a law or something, you know? You think it's like a rule because love and tolerance is our, you know? And they ask you, to say, what do you think about this thing about the room? And they're going to do away with the Lord. And you feel like you've got to, like, start a conversation and start thinking about this and everything like that. Next thing you know, you're getting upset. And you walk out of the room, you don't feel good. And you're ill at ease and you say, what happened? Because some guy invited you to the crazy alky dance and you decided to dance with him. When all you had to say was, I don't think about that. This, have a nice day and walk away. You don't have to be mean about it. It's amazing. How many times a day do people come up to you, do things come up to you begging for your attention, and you just don't have to give them attention? 9% of the stuff that I'm told to think about it and confront me during the day is none of my business. The 1% that is, the 10% that is my business, well, 90% of that, there's nothing I can do about it by thinking anyway. God's going to solve it. I'm powerless over it anyway. I got like one half of 1%. Like, and most of the other stuff is like going to the bathroom. There's no thought involved. I got to go. You know, where's the bathroom? You know, it's eating. I mean, the biggest problem I have in my life is trying to figure out the menu. You know, it can be very nerve-wracking, especially when there's a lot of choices. I hate when that happens, you know. So that's what the four-step is all about. You know, you start doing that deal, you start getting into this groove, it starts working. But you know how many alcoholics refuse to, you know, they'll hear something like I'm saying. And let me tell you something. I'm going to close by this. I was an academic. I was going for advanced math. I graduated departmental honors in mathematics. I was into algebraic topology. I am a believer in thinking. You know, I mean, if I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I didn't get on the spiritual path, I would believe that the answer to happiness is be brilliant, join Mensa, and think as much as possible. Be smart. And, you know, let me tell you something. Being smart has very little to do with being happy. There's a lot of very brilliant, unhappy people with broken marriages that don't have relationships, that are very lonely, that live very horrible lives. Being smart and brilliant and showing off to other people how smart and brilliant you are, you know, it may look good on the surface, but it's not necessarily the ticket to happiness. Or else we'd have a chapter in here saying into thinking. You know, I mean, it's not in there, okay? And when you're dealing with alcoholics whose egos tell them that they're smarter than everybody else, and the last thing they want to give up is their opportunity to play God by thinking this thing to death and controlling the world through their mind and controlling other people through their mind and making sure everybody else in the world knows how smart and brilliant they are. You know what I mean? You know, when you're dealing with alcoholics like that, that's a tough thing to lay off on the side. That's a tough thing. It's tough to go to a sponsor who didn't even graduate high school. You know, when you graduated and you have postgraduate degrees, to go to him and ask him, what should I do? And stay close to him. It's hard. Every guy who's ever sponsored me has had less education than me. Most of them don't have degrees or anything like that. You know, and they've just been members of Alcoholics Anonymous that spiritually they're so much farther developed than I'll ever be. You know, because I've put my faith in what this book talks about, a spiritual program of action, not an intellectual program of action. And so that's how it works for me. So that's the toughest thing, I think, to do. To basically, no matter how smart you think you are, say, you know, I don't know that much. I'm not that smart. I need help. And ask somebody to sponsor you and just do the steps and follow directions. So thank you very much. God bless you.